This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. President Bush met today at his ranch in Crawford, Texas, with senior advisors to work on a new approach to Iraq. The decision to revise policy follows Republican losses in elections widely perceived as a referendum on the war and the report of the Iraq Study Group. But while Iraq will undoubtedly be the centerpiece of the president's foreign policy, it is hardly his only challenge. In that same region, there are Iran, Syria, Lebanon, and the Israeli-Palestinian dispute. U.S. troops are engaged in a war in Afghanistan, which hinges on the support of the military regime in Pakistan. In Africa, Ethiopia went to war against Islamist forces in Somalia just this week, and there appears to be no end in sight to the crisis in the Darfur region of the Sudan. More broadly, a resurgent Russia flexes its energy exports in Asia and Europe. China is a rapidly growing economic and military power, and North Korea now owns nuclear weapons. President Bush declares his overarching goal is to spread liberty, human rights, and democracy, but critics point to Iraq and say that he's squandered many thousands of lives and billions of dollars in pursuit of unachievable ambitions. Later in the program, we'll follow up on some of the people we've talked to this past year, among them Christopher Paolini. The adaptation of his book Aragon is in movie theaters across the country at the moment. But first, a conversation about the direction and philosophy of foreign policy. We're going to speak with two men of distinctly different views. Joseph Nye served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration. He's now the University Distinguished Service Professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and author of Soft Power, The Means to Success in World Politics. Richard Perle is a leading neoconservative thinker who was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration. He's former chair of the Defense Policy Board and now a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. And we welcome your contributions. Is there an organizing principle to U.S. foreign policy? Should there be? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. Richard Perle joins us from the village of Gourdes in France, where he's on vacation, and it's nice to speak with you again.
It's a pleasure to talk to you.
And Joseph Nye is with us from North Sandwich, New Hampshire, where he, too, is on vacation, and thanks very much for being with us.
Glad to be with you.
Richard Perle, let's begin with you. Is there an organizing principle to U.S. foreign policy, and should there be?
Yes, I think there is, whether one adopts it or it is simply inflicted on you, and it is to protect the national interest by engaging adversaries when necessary and avoiding engagement when unnecessary. And I think that has largely been the policy pursued by almost every American president. The one great exception, I think, was Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan held the view that there was nothing inevitable about the Soviet Union, a view contrary to all his predecessors. And he set out to develop a strategy to bring it down, one that ultimately was successful. But by and large, we are a status quo power, seeking to preserve security with a minimum exertion.
Is Iraq a status quo policy? I think Richard Perle is taking his other phone off the hook. In the meantime, let's turn to you, Joseph Nye. Is there an organizing principle to U.S. foreign policy?
It's really hard to see one. I mean, the Bush administration came into power in the year 2001 with a view that they were going to have a policy of humility, as the president called it in the campaign of 2000. After 9/11, that changed quite dramatically, and they talked about transforming the Middle East. The road to Jerusalem would lie through Baghdad. If you ask, has that principle worked? The answer is no. Secretary Rice talks about transforming the Middle East, but it's transformed for worse rather than better. To go back to quoting Ronald Reagan, who was once commented, the way to judge a policy is to ask, are you better off today than you were when this started? And the answer is we're not better off. We're worse off.
Mm-hmm. Richard Perle, are you back with us?
Yes, I'm here.
I'm sorry. You were talking about U.S. as a status quo power. Is Iraq and this idea of transformation of the Middle East, is that a status quo idea?
Well, first of all, I don't accept that the transformation of the Middle East was the driving force behind the decision to go into Iraq. Without 9/11, we would not have gone into Iraq. However much we might wish to transform the Middle East, There was no plan to do so, certainly not by military means. We went into Iraq after 9/11 out of a belief that if we left Saddam Hussein in place, we might get a nasty surprise as we did when we had left Osama bin Laden in place. And it was a defensive move. It was not, although it is frequently described this way, it was not in pursuit of some grand design or some neoconservative vision. It was a defensive response to the fear that Saddam Hussein, in possession of weapons of mass destruction, might inflict great damage on the United States. And after 9/11, there was no inclination to wait around and find out whether that would happen or not.
And Joseph Nye, as I think you just said before, that's not what the president and some of his top advisors have said.
Well, I'm going to say certainly the search for weapons of mass destruction was one of several strands for going into Iraq. But it's a bit of revisionist history to say there was no aim to transform the Middle East. Look at the president's speech at the American Enterprise Institute in the winter of 2003 before the invasion. Look at what Secretary of Rice has said, what the president has said about what they're trying to do in the Middle East. I mean, that's nice revisionist history, but it simply doesn't fit with what the principal said.
Mm-hmm. And Richard Perrell, I'll let you come back one more time, and then we want to move on to broader subjects.
Yeah, you're conflating two things, Joe. One is the military action in Iraq, which the president never described as intended to change the Middle East, and a desire to bring about the evolution of democratic institutions in the Middle East, but not by military means. I don't know of any instance in which any senior official of the administration or the people who advise them suggested that we could transform the Middle East politically by using American military power. It's just a myth.
It's a myth which is pretty well documented, I believe, in various places. Woodward's book is one example. But I think if you go back to what the president himself said about the desire to transform the Middle East, it's clear that this was a transformational presidency in its aspiration. It was not a status quo presidency.
And let's move on to other areas of the world and other parts of U.S. foreign policy. And Richard Perrell, when the U.S. is engaged in a war in Afghanistan, however much it might foster policies of democracy in other countries in the world, it can't afford to do that necessarily in Pakistan.
Well, if by that you mean we can't afford to topple the Musharraf regime, I think that's quite right. It would be foolish to do that. Pakistan is a country with a significant Islamist element in it, radical Islamist element. It also happens to possess a considerable number of nuclear weapons, and only a fool would overturn that apple cart. The idea that we should be encouraging the evolution of democracy where we can doesn't mean that, like a bull in a china shop, we have to involve ourselves in every situation toward that end, no matter what the consequences. So we're not about to try to bring down a regime that's cooperating with us and that could very well be replaced if it did fall by a radical Islamist crowd with nuclear weapons.
And Joseph Nye, Richard Perrell has a point, yet critics point to this policy and say you're not consistent.
Well, it is the danger if you have rhetoric as let's say, aspirational or as high-blown as the president's second inaugural address, and then you live with regimes that you need, like Saudi Arabia or Pakistan, people accuse you of hypocrisy. And the answer to that is to be more realistic in your rhetoric and to realize that foreign policy always involves a degree of trade-offs. But right now, the Pakistan thing is particularly difficult because we may, having taken our eye off the ball in Afghanistan, be about to lose Afghanistan, which I think would be a grave mistake, and yet we can't solve the Afghanistan problem without working with Pakistan.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. We're speaking with Richard Perrell and Joseph Nye. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And let's begin with Jeff. Jeff calling us from Jacksonville in Florida.
Hi, how are you today? I enjoy your show.
Thank you.
The question I had, first of all, I'd like to preface it with agreeing that Mr. Pearl has a bit of a revisionist history of our the lead-up going into the Iraq War. That said, my question is, I'd like to get a response from you and your guests, reference U.S. Hegemonic activities around the world and advancing U.S. interests, which is laudable as a nation, but with the means and methods that we have used over the years, both over Democratic and Republican administrations, it seems to me that the use of American power has been one that is designed at all costs to expand U.S. Presence and U.S. power and U.S. economic interest around the world.
And when you say hegemonic power, you mean the policy of the U.S. is the only superpower and we should make sure that we stay that way?
Essentially, exactly.
All right, let's get a response from that. Joseph Nye.
Well, the paradox of American power is that we're the strongest country since the days of Rome, and yet we can't protect our citizens acting alone. We indeed outstrip all the rest in terms of size, particularly of our military power, but we haven't learned that unless you get cooperation with others, you can't protect ourselves. And that's what I call soft power, the ability to attract others as well as to use hard power to coerce them. We did it in the Cold War. We combined hard and soft power into a smart power strategy. We haven't done it in the current period since 2001.
And, Jeff, if you'll stay with us, we'll get a response from Richard Pearl after we come back from a break. I don't want to limit him to just the few seconds we have left in this segment. So hang on with us. I'll put you on hold if I can remember to hit the right button. There we go. Did it for once. And we'll be back shortly. We're speaking with Richard Pearl, currently a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and Joseph Nye, Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration, now Distinguished Service Professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. If you'd like to join our conversation about the direction and purpose of U.S. foreign policy, is there an organizing principle? Ought there to be? 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Monday at this time, New Year's Day, we're going to remember the people who passed away this past year and how they made a difference in our lives. We invite you to help us out by nominating people you'd like to remember. Send us an email, talk@npr.org. Put "made a difference" in the subject line. Tell us as much as you can about the person you want to remember and why, and we'll post the emails on New Year's Day. Right now, we're talking about the direction and philosophy of U.S. foreign policy. Our guests are Joseph Nye, who served as Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Clinton administration, now University Professor at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. Richard Pearl, Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan administration, former Chair of the Defense Policy Board, now Resident Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org, and let's get Jeff back on the line. And Richard Pearl, before the break, he was asking about the policy of the United States, which is a stated policy of we are the sole superpower and ought to make sure that no other powers emerge to rival that status.
Well, we certainly would not welcome a return of a situation like the Cold War, where we faced an aggressive and very dangerous Soviet Empire. Having said that, I certainly agree with Joe Nye that one uses all the instruments available in order to achieve our basic objective, which is to protect the security and the interests of the United States. I don't know what the caller means when he talks about hegemonic power.
Neil, I can explain.
Go ahead, Jeff.
What I mean by that is I would agree that a nation has the obligation to advance its interests. And that is by, soft power and rarely, I would say, by use of raw power. That being said, it seems there's a double standard. It seems that everybody would agree that the U.S. has the right to use whatever disposal means at its disposal to advance its interests. But the irony or the hypocrisy comes out when we condemn other countries that are trying to advance their own interests that may not be in line with ours.
Give me an example.
I'm sorry?
Give me an example.
give an example, Iran.
Case
in point.
Richard Pearl.
Well, we're obviously concerned, as are many other countries, about the prospect of a nuclear weapon in the hands of the Iranians, and in particular in the hands of someone like Ahmadinejad, who comes close to threatening genocide when he talks about eliminating Israel from the face of the earth while he is engaged in moving as quickly as he can to acquire nuclear weapons. Now, you can call it hypocrisy if you like that we're critical of that. I think it's just common sense.
Well, Mr. Pearl, I would
say, and even apprehensive.
Well, it's convenient to focus on the nuclear aspects, even though those are hypothetical. Iran has said directly that they aren't engaged in anything other than peaceful use of nuclear technology, and it's speculation on your part.
Well, Jeff, to be fair, there are very few who believe that.
Well, I'm just saying. What I'm more getting at.
Well, then let's talk about another aspect of Iran.
No, hang on a second.
Let's talk about Iran's support for terrorism. Is it hypocritical to condemn the fact that Iran is probably the single most persistent source of help to terrorists in the world today?
Well, I would think people would argue with that. I would say Afghanistan is still a great source, and Pakistan more so than maybe not state, but as a region, Pakistan generates more terrorists than Iran does through their proxies. But well, given that as may, Iran has a vested interest in the area, has a vested interest in its border with Iraq.
And Jeff, you've got a point, but I wanted to give somebody else a chance. You've been on for quite a while. Appreciate the phone call, though. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Let's turn now to, this is Phil. Phil's with us from Nashville, Tennessee.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
And my question was basically touched upon earlier, and it's got to do with the hypocrisy, for lack of a better word. But essentially, I wondered why the organizing principle of U.S. foreign policy isn't to support human rights, regardless of who we may engage negatively, say Israel or Saudi Arabia, as a result of that policy. It seems like you just go in a circle by constantly just supporting people like Pakistan who support your interests at the moment, but in the end you strengthen, you know, a military junta. And that's basically my question. Like I said, you guys already touched on it.
Well, Joseph Nye, it touches also on situations like Darfur in Sudan.
Well, that's right. I mean, certainly human rights and humanitarian assistance are an important part of a foreign policy. But if you just had a human rights policy, you wouldn't have a foreign policy. A foreign policy means trading off different objectives to try to get as much as you can in forwarding or promoting a national interest. And if you only paid attention to human rights, and you led then to the overthrow of the Musharraf government, and then you led to al-Qaeda taking over nuclear weapons, that clearly is not something you want to accomplish in a foreign policy. So you have to face trade-offs.
Well, I'm not suggesting that we topple the Musharraf government as we did Iraq. I mean, I'm just saying sanctions against them, you know, working to get them to change, to hold the elections that President Musharraf has promised but never actually held for quite a while.
No, that makes sense. And we certainly should be trying to persuade Musharraf to let the civilian parties back into the equation, which he's been reluctant to do. Because in the longer term, we're not going to get stability in Pakistan unless we move in that direction. But there's a difference between long run and short run there.
Phil, thanks very much.
All right, thank you.
Richard Pearl, you spoke earlier about the Reagan policy toward the Soviet Union, the evil empire. Is China an even evil empire?
Well, it's certainly not to be compared to the Soviet Union. No, I would not say China is an evil empire, although there are aspects of Chinese policy that one doesn't like. I'm hopeful that we can avoid the kind of relationship that we had with the Soviet Union as China emerges. There's nothing automatic about an adversarial relationship.
Yet China has certainly human rights problems. It is fast developing its military power, still much smaller than that of the United States, but worrisome to some.
Well, it's impossible to say now where China is going. The fact that it is investing heavily in military power when there's no obvious threat to China is a concern, and no one's going to defend the Chinese record on human rights. And we ought to be putting pressure on the Chinese and others to improve their performance on human rights. I don't see any inconsistency between a policy of promoting human rights and a practical policy of defending America's interests. You have to strike balances in some situations. I think we would all agree with that. Joe and I, we might not draw the line in exactly the same place, but we would certainly agree that lines need to be drawn.
Joe Nye?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we have a number of objectives in China. One of the most interesting ones is, what do we do as China increases its power over the next 20 or 30 years? I think that the rise of Chinese power and the question of political Islam are two of the biggest questions we face. We know how to manage something like the rise of Chinese power. We've seen that before in history. Dealing with non-state actors that are energized by extreme Islamism and can use terrorism, that's something we don't know how to handle. We need actually have relatively good relations with China if we're going to concentrate on what I think is the more difficult challenge.
After 9/11, President Bush seemed to say that maybe the organizing principle of American foreign policy ought to be the global war on terrorism, the challenge of our generation, the calling of our time, he said. Is that an analogy that's useful, do you think, Joseph Nye?
Well, I think the fact that it's going to be a generation-long struggle is true. Terrorism tends to go in generation-long waves. The big mistake is to call it a war. It's not a war, and you don't have a war on a technique. We have a generation-long struggle against extremist political Islamist ideology, which is trying to essentially take over Islam to enforce their views on a minority. But every time we call it a war, we fall into the trap of using the terminology that Bin Laden and the extremists want us to use, because they want to convince other Muslims that essentially it is a war against Islam. So much better to call it a generation-long struggle against a radical group than it is to call it a war on terror, which in fact is a counterproductive way of describing it.
Richard Pearl?
Well, I don't have a big argument with that or about what it's called. I do think that the nature of that threat is without precedent because the techniques that we've developed over a long period of time to deal with physical threats to Americans don't work very well if you're dealing with extremists who are suicidal, indeed, who crave martyrdom. And so we need to develop policies and techniques that we've never needed in the past, and it's going to be difficult. It's going to take a long time. And I'm afraid that we're likely to be hit again before this all comes to an end. So calling that the central challenge, which I think was the point of the president's remarks, is I think quite right. We didn't ask for this, but now that it's happened, we have no choice but to deal with it.
What about a more familiar adversary, Russia, which of course still has plenty of nuclear weapons? It has new sources of vast wealth in terms of its energy exports, in terms of gas and petroleum, and has shown its willingness to use that economic muscle and that energy resources to, I don't think it's too strong a word, to say bully its neighbors, Richard Pearl.
Well, that's a very apt description of the current Russian policy. And it's a great shame. At a time when Russia could be developing along entirely different lines, it's becoming more authoritarian, less free. Clearly, Putin is grabbing every national resource he can get his hands on, whether it's at the moment in the private sector or not, and using that economic power to intimidate his neighbors. The Russian people in the end will pay a price for this, because this is not a successful strategy for the development of Russia.
And Joseph Nye, this is a big challenge for American foreign policy.
Yeah, Russia is difficult because essentially it is going through, as Richard said, a very bad spell. Putin is throwing his weight around. They're using energy to recover a semblance of superpowerdom, but they're not going to make it. One problem is that they've got a tremendous demographic problem. They're going to lose population over time. Another is they've got a tremendous health problem. And they're dependent on an unbalanced economy, which is based entirely on oil and gas. These are very dangerous signals for the long-term future. In the meantime, they have nuclear weapons, and their positions on things like exporting nuclear technology to Iran will make or break our policy on that case. So we're stuck with a country which is essentially in the short run feeling its oats, but in the long run doesn't have most oats behind it, but can cause a lot of trouble in the meantime.
We're speaking about the philosophy and direction of U.S. foreign policy in the future. Our guests are Joseph Nye and Richard Pearl, 800-989-8255, if you'd like to join us. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Dave on the line. Dave calling us from the road in Los Angeles.
Hey, are you there?
Yes, we're there. Go ahead, please.
Listen, I'm listening to the conversation. I have to say I'm troubled by what we keep referring to as foreign policy. I think if we talk about countries as people and we talk about making decisions that further our best interests, it seems wildly opportunistic and a rather odious trait in a person. Why do we accept it on the national level? Like, for example, in Darfur, if my neighbor were knocking the crap out of his kids, I would stop that. Why as a nation are we allowing that to continue?
Joseph Nye?
Well, I think we should be doing more about Darfur. I think there are a number of steps that we could be taking to put more pressure on the Sudanese government. On the other hand, if you say, what can I do about it, unlike your neighbor where you can go next door and stop him or you can call the police to get them to stop him, there isn't an international police to stop. And if you ask, are we in a position to actually put force into Darfur to stop him, the answer is no. So international politics isn't just like living with your neighbor next door. It's a lot more complicated.
And it's true. And I think, honestly, that's part of the problem, because we're always looking out for what's in our best interest, how can we achieve our interests, instead of probably what's best for the whole. And I think that's all I wanted to say, is the distancing mechanism by using something called foreign policy is just description of behaviors. And I think a lot of the behavior that we participate in under the umbrella of foreign policy is simply odious.
Dave, thanks for the call. Richard Pearl, certainly Darfur presents very difficult issues.
Well, I think it's a disgrace that we're not doing more to deal with the situation in Darfur, just as our reaction to Rwanda was a disgrace, and Bosnia before that. The fact is that in each of these cases, an early use of very limited force could almost certainly have averted a much larger humanitarian catastrophe. And we've chosen in each case not to get involved, or in the case of Bosnia, to wait until 250,000 people were dead before we decided to get involved. I would like to see us alert to the possibilities of a limited application of force together with other countries early in these situations before they get completely out of hand.
And let's see if we can get one last caller on the line before we have to go. This is Jessica. Jessica, where are you calling from?
Raleigh, North Carolina.
Go ahead, please.
Hi. I recently read a book called Hubbard's Peak, and there seems to be a great deal of agreement that we are nearly out of oil in the world. I'd like to know where your panelists stand on that issue, what they think the U.S. foreign policy will be in the geopolitical struggle for oil in the coming years.
Joseph Nye, why don't you go first and try to keep it brief, because we just have a couple of minutes left.
Hubbard's Peak is controversial among oil experts. It's generally agreed, though, whether oil peaks in the next 10 years or the next 50 years, two-thirds of the oil reserves are in the Persian Gulf, which is one of the most unstable regions of the world. So we're stuck with the fact that even if we could reduce our dependence on the Persian Gulf, the world economy can't, and that would affect our economy. We're going to have to pay attention to the Persian Gulf, like it or not, because until the world economy weans itself from oil, which is a ways off, that's where most of the oil is.
Richard Pearl, we'll give you the last word.
Yeah, it isn't going to be cheap or easy, but we had better start developing serious alternatives to dependence on fossil fuel. And it's we failed to do so. The economics have always been adverse, although at current prices they're a lot more favorable. But between nuclear energy and new fuels coming on and investment in technology, we'd better get busy.
But very quickly, as Joseph Nye said, even if we do it, the rest of the world probably won't.
No, but to the degree to which technological innovation does things, for example, like permit the conversion of coal, of which there is a huge quantity in the world, into an environmentally effective and cost-effective fuel, what we do in developing technology will benefit the whole world.
Okay. Jessica, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you so much.
And I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. A fascinating discussion. Richard Pearl, thanks very much for taking time from your vacation to speak with us.
All the best.
Richard Pearl, currently a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, speaking with us from Gourdes in Provence in France. And Joseph Nye, Happy New Year. Thanks for taking time from your vacation to speak with us.
And Happy New Year to you from me and all my 9 grandchildren.
Congratulations on all of that. Joseph Nye with us from North Sandwich in New Hampshire. We'll be back after the break to speak with the author of Aragon. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.